Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, bringing you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know and that the mainstream media is not reporting. Tune in every day to hear what is going on that you can't get on your mainstream newspapers, on CNN. I tell you what's going on, and that's my job, and that's what I see it as I got to do. Today, of course, our topic is how Al Gore might well have prevented the September 11th terrorist attacks. Now, I don't know about you, but ever since September 11th, when I've talked with right-wingers about the terrorist attacks, a lot of times I hear this really snide comment from them. It's, oh, well, you know, at least I'm glad Al Gore wasn't president. They seem to be suggesting that if the American people had had their way, of course, the American people preferred Al Gore over George Bush, and the people of Florida preferred Gore over George Bush. If the election had been allowed to go according to the Constitution, according to democracy, and Al Gore were president, we'd all be in big trouble. And these Republicans seem to suggest that, oh, they're really glad that the Supreme Court violated the law and overturned the Constitution and installed their guy George Bush in, because thank God George Bush was there to protect us on September 11th. They usually fail to mention the fact that he was nowhere to be found. He was hiding from the public, much as he's hiding from the public today. In fact, as I'm sure you know, George Bush and his vice president, Dick Cheney, right by his side, took questions from the 9/11 Commission today. Now, these are questions that they fought all along from the beginning. They fought, of course, to even have the commission in the first place, and then they said they wanted no more than an hour of talks, and finally they agreed that they could talk, but only if they went together. Just like any two criminals who commit a crime, they got to get their story straight. And they did not want to go separate, because if they go separate, they can be caught in each other's lies. And that makes sense, because the president and the vice president lie so often, it's very hard for them to remember who told what story. So in order to get their story straight, they're going to go before the commission, but hey, and they went this morning. But hey, no notes. The only ones that are allowed to record it, of course, are the White House. That way they can play selective portions of it later. No staff in the room. No stenographers. The 9/11 Commission is going to try to take notes at the same time as they ask questions. It's not going to be easy. But hey, telling the truth and getting the truth from this president is never easy. We all know it's virtually impossible. So they met today, and apparently they went just a little over 3 hours, which is about an hour and a half apiece. So after saying we won't go for more than an hour, well, you know, they conceded to truth, justice, the American way. They went an hour and a half. An hour and a half. Wow. 3,000 Americans died, and, 3 hours for both of them. I guess, let's see, that's 1,000 Americans an hour for both of them, or, you know, of course, I guess it's 2,000 if you look at it the way that each could only talk one at a time. But, you know, hey, the president has important things to do. He's got fundraising to go to. He's got to raise hundreds of millions of dollars. He has to try to find some way to trash John Kerry's Vietnam record, which isn't easy to do when the man has three Purple Hearts. But they're going to try. They have to do what they can. So protecting our country from terrorism, just not a priority for George Bush. Wasn't before September 11th and isn't today. But the question that we pose this hour, I think, is a more interesting one. The question that we're going to pose is whether Al Gore, if he had been chosen president by the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court had respected the views of the American people that chose Gore as president, would we have prevented September 11th? And my guest is going to be Dr. Elaine Kmart. She's a professor at Harvard University, and she was the staff member for the commission, the Gore Commission on Aviation Safety and Security. Have you heard of the Gore Commission? Because a lot of folks haven't. The Gore Commission was began under President Clinton after the TWA flight went down. Turned out it wasn't down by a terrorist attack. But they wanted to examine aviation safety and security. And so in February 1997, the Gore Commission issued a report. And you might be surprised to know that a lot of the things that we've now done to protect airline security after 9/11 were recommended by Al Gore 6 years ago, more than 4 years, actually 7 years ago now, and certainly more than 4 years before September 11th. So I hope you'll take this chance to call in. Dr. Elaine K. Mark is a really special guest. It's very important to have her here because it's to get the inside of another administration, the Clinton-Gore administration, and how they had plans to stop terrorism, specifically how to stop the kind of aviation terrorism that led to the attacks on September 11th. And again, this is news that the mainstream reporters just aren't reporting. You might find it... I don't even know if you'd find it on page 826 of the New York Times because it's new, it's old news. And the mainstream reporters don't like to do old news. They don't like to point out that if Al Gore were president, hey, we wouldn't have had 9/11 because that's not relevant, they think, to today. And yet, Republicans are going around saying how pleased they are that George Bush was our president. So I hope you'll call in. I hope you'll ask Elaine K. Mark some good questions about what Gore had planned and more generally, what it is that Al Gore could have done, should have done, would have done, could have done to stop the terrorist attacks of September 11th. The phone number to call in is 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. You can also email me and email your question to Elaine K. Mark by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. We're going to explore not just the Gore Commission on Aviation Security and Safety, though that's largely what we're going to talk about, but in general, how it was that our government was prepared or unprepared for September 11th. And I want to know from you, do you think that Al Gore would have done a better job? Do you think that Bill Clinton did a better job? You know, I hear the Republicans go on and on and on about, oh, Clinton didn't respond enough, didn't respond enough. But I remember back in 1998, wasn't that long ago, when Bill Clinton let go some cruise missiles, attacked, just barely missed Osama bin Laden by 3 hours. Just barely missed the guy. That's a lot closer than Bush has ever gotten since September 11th. And at the same time, Clinton also attacked Iraq. In fact, it is now known that the very last weapons of mass destruction that Iraq had were destroyed by Bill Clinton in 1998 when Saddam Hussein removed the UN weapons inspectors. But what I ask you to remember is not how Clinton helped protect us from terrorism there and a year later to stop the Millennium Bomber from coming in to bomb L.A. Airport. But do you remember the Republicans' response? Who remembers? 877-57-SCOOP. What I seem to recall in 1998, is that the Republicans were extremely upset. How dare Bill Clinton attack Afghanistan? How dare Bill Clinton attack Iraq? He's trying to take America's attention off of what really matters. And what really matters the most to American safety and security? Monica Lewinsky. That's right. Bill Clinton was wrong, wrong, wrong. How dare he attack terrorists in Afghanistan and Iraq? He's just trying to take the nation's attention off of what really matters, his impeachment for having sex with Monica Lewinsky. And they went on and they condemned him, and they condemned him so much that we now know the Clinton administration became nervous about taking military action because of all the condemnation. And I want to know if you think that that's right, if you think that's fair, if you think that I'm telling the story right, or hey, I know I got some conservative listeners out there. Do you think I'm overstating the case? Because I don't think so. Again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And we'll be back with Dr. Elaine K. Mark, the staff member of the Gore Commission on Aviation Security and Safety, discussing what Al Gore could have done to prevent 9/11. Again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. Call in or email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be back with the Inside Scoop and Dr. Elaine K. Mark right after this.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. It'll soon be easier to follow the flow of U.S. jobs overseas due to the latest initiative by the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers and the Communication Workers of America. The groups are launching a website called Offshore Tracker that will include the total number of jobs sent offshore by date and details about companies exporting the jobs. CWA and WashTech expect they'll only be counting about 20% of jobs lost because many companies force their employees to sign non-disclosure agreements. The website is www.techsunite.org/offshore.
In what's believed to be the largest public settlement ever for a case involving HIV-related discrimination, a former performer with Cirque du Soleil will receive $600,000 from the avant-garde acrobatic troupe. Matthew Cusick was fired from the troupe's resident show in Las Vegas last July after his HIV-positive status was revealed, even though company physicians cleared him for performance. Claims that Cusick was a safety hazard provided the justification. But following an investigation by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which concluded Cirque du Soleil had discriminated by firing Cusick, the company agreed to the settlement yesterday.
After a year-long strike against meat processing giant Tyson Foods, the membership of the United Food and Commercial Workers Wisconsin Local 538 elected a new president. Of the 329 striking union workers who have asked to come back to work at the Jefferson, Wisconsin plant, 120 are still waiting to return. The new president will have to deal with this, ongoing contract talks with Oscar Mayer, and negotiations with Jones Dairy expected to begin this summer.
Only essential and emergency health services are available in British Columbia this week as 43,000 hospital and clinic workers with Canada's Hospital Employees Union strike to stop a government campaign to privatize the province's health care. Since the government opened up the sector to contracting out 2 years ago, one out of every eight health care workers in the province have either been laid off or seen their wages dramatically reduced. The walkout began on Sunday, but yesterday the BC government took the steps toward ordering the strike to be stopped, which could result in the issuance of a back-to-work order by as early as tomorrow.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to the Labor Research Association, President Bush, unlike the 8.4 million unemployed workers in the United States, has more money than he can spend. Bush has raised so much money that he's suspended all further fundraising for his 2004 presidential campaign. Bush now has the largest campaign fund of any candidate in U.S. history, $180 million. His Democratic challenger, John Kerry's war chest, is $100 million short of that amount.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And I think one thing that the Bush administration probably does not want you to know most about is the Gore Commission on Aviation Security and Safety. A lot of Republicans make snide comments to suggest that Al Gore would not have done as good a job after 9/11 as George Bush. But what we're just finding out, and what really hasn't been reported very widely, is that Al Gore, long before 9/11, was taking steps to protect aviation security and safety. And my guest, Dr. Elaine Kmark, a professor at Harvard University, was the staff member on that commission. Dr. Kmark, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Tell me this. The Gore Commission, what were the circumstances that set it up? And tell me some of its primary recommendations.
Well, it was set up right after the crash of TWA 800 in off of Long Island in the summer of 1996. And it was set up because it was, well, for two reasons. First of all, Al Gore, in his Reinventing Government work, had been pointing out for 3 years the problems with aviation safety, particularly the air traffic control system. So the president knew that Al Gore was very concerned about the sort of state of American airline safety in general, both technically and terrorist-wise. But initially, also, TWA 800 looked like it could have been a terrorist attack. The plane just blew apart in the air, and of course the first thought was that there was a bomb on the plane. So the president within days asked Al Gore to head a commission on airline safety and security.
And that commission delivered its report, I believe, in February 1997. Is that right?
Right. The commission report actually came out, interestingly enough, in two stages. We rushed to do a review of airline security because in the initial months when the investigation was still going on and people thought it was a bomb, the initial worry was to strengthen the security at airports. And so there were a whole series of recommendations that actually came out very early. They came out in September of 1996, which dealt with aviation security.
Let me give out the number just again for listeners that want to call and ask you questions. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. If you prefer the numbers, it's 877-577-2667. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at radioinsidescoop.com. I want to ask you, Dr. K. Mark, about some of the recommendations that might have indeed been useful before September 11th. And we can just take them one by one. Let's start, I guess, with passenger screening. Was that one of the recommendations?
Yes, there was a recommendation to institute what was known as the CAPS system to try and make sure that security information, there were lots of recommendations. The overall one, by the way, was to treat aviation security as a national security issue. Something that was given basically kind of lip service, sort of in the way that by the bureaucracy, sort of the way that, you know, George Tenet's war on terrorism back in 1997 was. But basically the first one was to treat it as a national security issue and to make sure that the CIA and the FBI provided to the Federal Aviation Administration and to the airlines on a regular basis information about dangerous and people and suspected terrorists.
So when you say treat it as a national security issue, you mean that that would have provided more information to the airlines? Or would what else would it have done?
That encompassed a whole range of recommendations, from providing information to the airlines about who was flying and recent intelligence information, which of course we now know on September 11th was not provided, to improving the screeners at the airport who were checking baggage for bombs, to buying, which we did in that fall of 96, buying explosive detection devices to be installed at airports around the country, again, looking for bombs, explosives, et cetera. So there were a whole series of recommendations, about 20-some, that were geared towards security, and you probably didn't hear much about them then, but all of them were relevant after September 11th.
Well, and let's just go through each of them real quickly, one by one. There was better screeners, because the screeners prior to September 11th were private. A lot of people don't even know this. When they went to the airport before September 11th, those were private companies that had those streamers, the screeners, and in fact, some of them had pretty bad records. Isn't that right?
Yes, and in fact, our recommendation was we stayed out of the question of whether or not they should be public or private, because the important issue for us was that their training had to be dramatically increased. They were not being trained properly. They weren't being checked properly. We made a recommendation requiring them to get FBI fingerprint checks before they could be employed as screeners. And again, the government had the, even though they were private then, the government had the authority to do this because they regulated those screeners.
And criminal background checks as well, right?
Well, that's what we mean by FBI.
Okay.
Basically, criminal background checks, yes.
And in fact, another thing I noticed in the report is aggressive testing, that you would go in and check and make sure they weren't falling asleep.
That's right. We called for aggressive testing, not just of the screeners, but we called for aggressive testing of the security of the airports themselves. We found during this investigation that it was very easy to get on airplanes. They weren't locked at night because they were left open for cleaning people to come in and clean them. They sat there basically open overnight. Hmm. We found that there were holes in fences around airports, very easy for unauthorized people to get into airports. Basically, we called for an upgrading in the security testing right across the board, everything having to do with an airport.
Okay. And we'll get to some other examples later, but let me ask you about these in terms of, I mean, for example, the fact that an airline, a plane could be left overnight without doors locked, it certainly concerns me. How many of these recommendations were put into effect prior to September 11th, after your report, and how many afterwards?
Well, it's not, as you know, with the government, it's never very clear cut. To summarize, I think, what happened on the security regulations. Now, there were safety-related regulations, too.
Right.
That before September 11th, almost all of them were completed as rules. In other words, the formal government process of making it a rule which required the airlines or the airports to do this and that, most of those were completed in the legal sense. But that's that one of the things we discovered since then, and with the help of some investigative reporting, is that they might have been there on the books, but they weren't really being implemented. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
The requirement that airport screeners get additional training. Well before September 11th, additional training was developed for computers, you know, kind of interactive training to improve the skills of the screeners. That training and those computers were bought by the government and distributed to airports. And then when the inspector general went around to sort of look at these things, what the inspector general found was that the actual computer terminals were often placed in locations in the airports that the screeners couldn't get to on their breaks. In other words, there would be no room for them close by. They would be placed, you know, ways away where they'd have to take a shuttle bus, et cetera.
Hmm.
Not surprisingly, the screeners were not using the extra training. They were falling behind on the requirement for additional training. So a lot of this was that these things were kind of on the books, but they were not well implemented. People weren't paying a lot of attention to this kind of thing, and they weren't forcing the implementation.
Well, is it fair to say that some of the main reason why these ideas were not implemented very well was because of resistance from the airlines, that they thought it would be too expensive, and
absolutely.
Republicans
in Congress
who supported them?
The biggest resistance, well, the airlines resisted the whole commission.
Okay.
Let's start with that.
All right.
The airline story is interesting. They resisted everything, the existence of the commission, right? But then what happened was that when TWA 800 was found to be an accident, not a terrorist attack, okay?
Right.
There was fumes in the car, in the fuel tank that
right.
caused it to blow up. Our commission then did another series of recommendations, and these had to do with the technical safety of airplanes. Now, if you look back historically, it's very interesting. Obviously, what happened was recommendations we made, for instance, to put smoke detectors and flame detectors in cargo holds,
okay,
which was the cause of the value jet crash in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
That rule went through in exactly a year, which is very fast for rulemaking. And even before the rule was published, most of the airlines were voluntarily refitting their airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening was, and this is partially because they chose to, this is where they chose to spend their money, and partially because this is where all the crashes had been, is they chose to spend their money on the things, the safety-related recommendations, like the smoke detectors in cargo holds, and then they dragged their feet and didn't pay much attention in order to save money on the security-related ones.
Dr. Kidmark, I'm curious if Congress could have been more help in this regard. I noticed in looking through some of the research prepared for this program that the airlines gave three times the money, campaign money, to George Bush as they did to Al Gore in the 2000 election. And I wonder if you think that might be related to the push by the Gore Commission to provide for airline safety and security, and whether you think that politics has played a role, at least prior to 9/11, in keeping a lot of these suggestions from being implemented.
There's no doubt that we battled the airlines throughout much of 96, 97, 98, and even into 99 as these things were getting implemented. And there's no doubt that I'm sure that the airlines would much rather have seen George Bush be president than Al Gore, partially because Al Gore had their number, both in terms of the security problems at airports and in terms of the safety problems with their own planes. So there's no doubt. And Congress also plays a role here, because Congress itself had, about the same time, had its own commission. That commission never even addressed airline security. they only looked at the safety side of air travel. They only looked at, you know, technical aspects of airplanes, et cetera, which I don't want to denigrate.
That's important, but it's not
important.
The whole story, right.
But that was obviously not the whole story. In other words, there's two ways that you can have terrible air disasters. One is things wrong with the airplanes, and the government should regulate that, and we did look at those. But the other is terrorist attacks, whether it's a bomb or the kinds of suicide attempts we saw, suicide bombings that we saw in 9/11. So you really had to look at both. Congress never looked at security. They had an entire commission. They never looked at security issues. So clearly,
Why do you think that is, Dr. K. Mark? Why do you think Congress did not look at security?
Well, I mean, I think that there's two reasons. First of all, that was the area that the airlines fought the hardest. Okay.
Because it was expensive? Is that the reason they fought it? Or I assume that's the reason they fought it. Money.
Because it cost them money.
Right.
I mean, if anything, the most important things to do with security, at least in that period, revolved around the screening of passengers, which was going to cost the airlines money, and the screening of baggage. Now, even though the federal government was buying some of these baggage machines, okay, it was disrupting the airlines' flow. It was disrupting some of their schedules. Those days, they had the hub system invented, and they didn't like the. They thought that the baggage slow down their flights and disrupt their hub system. They were really, really opposed to most of the security recommendations. Whereas on the safety side, they were more willing to go along. I think the other thing, I think they're plenty guilty here, but I also want to give them the benefit of a doubt. I think the other thing that needs to be said, though, is that if you look at the decade of the 90s, the big dramatic airplane crashes were, in fact, all technical and safety-related. In other words, we had TWA and we had ValueJet, et cetera.
That may be true in the United States, but certainly I'm well aware of the Egyptian flight where the pilot is at least alleged, and I think relatively proven, to have taken that plane all the way down. There was another one, in fact, again, this is all with hindsight, but as I recall, there was a plot to fly a plane into the Eiffel Tower into Paris.
Yes, there was.
Did your commission look at any of these, I mean, these harbingers, if you will, of 9/11, whether you look at the plane, you know, the pilot flying the plane into the ground or another one into the Eiffel Tower in Egypt and in Paris? Did you look at any of these foreign suggestions of how terrorists might attack planes?
Yeah, there was a lot of that. There was looking at that. I can't say that was the whole focus because, again, we were trapped by the TWA tragedy, which turned out to be, you know, a technical problem, a safety problem. But we did look at those, but we were also influenced by the Pan Am 103.
Which was a terrorist attack.
A terrorist attack, right.
Just for our listeners, most of you probably know what this is, but this is the attack that by Libya, many people say by Syria as well, that killed hundreds of people over Lockerbie, Scotland.
That's right. And so that also was influencing us. I mean, I can't say that we anticipated terrorists flying things into buildings in the United States.
Okay.
We didn't specifically anticipate that, but we were very aware of the fact that airlines were a prime target of terrorists. We were more consumed, frankly, with bombers than we were with hijackers. And in retrospect, we probably should have paid more attention to hijackings, although that hadn't happened in so long, and what we had seen was lots of attempts to blow up airplanes.
Well, let me ask you something about that, because there's an article in the New Republic regarding your commission. It just came out, and it's a small point in a larger article. But Martin Peretz writes that two ideas, which clearly would have been very important, protective devices and cockpits and sky marshals, he writes, were shelved by the commission when it became clear they would be politically impossible. Israel's El Al airline, by the way, has for a long time, for decades, provided two locked steel reinforced doors to separate the pilot cockpit from the passenger space. And they also have at least two armed guards. In fact, they're armed with special weapons that can shoot someone but not make a plane go down.
Right.
Did you look at El Al and I want to know if you agree with Peretz's assertion that you considered these two ideas, devices and cockpits and sky marshals, but shelved them because they were politically impossible?
We did look at El Al. We did not look at the cockpits. Okay. We looked at the cockpits in a different aspect, ironically, which I think has gotten confused. We looked at the cockpits in terms of various and sundry safety warning things we would put in cockpits, like smoke detectors and like things to warn pilots about flying into mountains, which was one of the crashes that had happened.
Right, I remember that one.
So we looked at the cockpit design, we looked at pilot training, but we really did look at this not in terms of people entering the cockpits, but more in terms of pilot safety. In terms of the air marshals, we didn't think that was very feasible. And frankly,
because
we were more concerned
or?
with securing the perimeter of the airports and securing in other words, increasing the security as you went into the airport than once on the plane.
So I guess obviously Israel is a country that's frequently attacked by terrorists and takes more precautions than most. But I guess there's a feeling that what El Al did would be way too expensive for the United States.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, remember, Israel has just one airline.
Right, that's true.
And it's state supported, and it's
and
very
far
small.
Fewer flights than all the flights that we have in America.
Yeah, I can't imagine that we would have. I mean, and look, if you look back on this, I mean, part of the problem here, you didn't need an air marshal to stop those guys, okay? That because, in fact, in Pennsylvania,
right.
a bunch of the passengers, and believe me, if somebody started rushing towards the cockpit today, you know that, a bunch of women on the plane would stop
them. We've seen it with the British bomber, Richard Reid, in fact.
Yeah, exactly.
They did stop it, though, of course, in Pennsylvania. They didn't save their own lives, unfortunately.
They didn't save their own lives, but they did stop it.
Yes,
and they
did.
Probably kept it from going into the White House or the Congress. I think that the reason the air marshals is kind of an irrelevant issue is that what really happened on those 9/11 flights was that the crew and the pilots were led to believe that this was going to be more or less a traditional hijacking. And they were taught under the rules about hijacking to cooperate, and they figured probably the worst that was going to happen to them was they were going to end up in Havana, you know, but then everybody would get off the plane because that was the rule with hijacking.
Right.
And I don't think anybody in the pre-9/11 on those planes until word reached those people on the plane in Pennsylvania, I don't think any of them thought that because, frankly, there weren't that many people. They weren't armed very heavily. There's no reason that normal Americans couldn't have stopped that had they understood what was going to happen.
Dr. K. Mark, we have to go to commercial break. But when we come back, I want to ask you really the ultimate question, and that is whether you think if Al Gore had been allowed to win the election that he got the most votes in, if the Supreme Court had allowed the votes to be counted in Florida and Al Gore were president, whether you think that some of these recommendations that you had on the Gore Commission would have been implemented faster and might even have played a role in preventing 9/11. It's a tough question, but I'll give you the commercial break to think about it. If you want to call in, please do. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. Ask Dr. K. Mark your questions. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. We'll be back with the Inside Scoop right after this.
Bushite's favorite words is robust. It implies vigor, action, power. It's a manly sort of word that they punch out of their mouths like a fist. They've been using the word a lot lately to buff up George's image as an unrelenting foe of terrorism who's battling every aspect of the global terrorist network. The president is robust in his commitment, they bark at anyone who dares question Bush's actions or inactions. Yet there's one aspect of battling terrorism that the Bushites have gotten downright wimpy about: tracking down the money that finances the global network. While George himself has talked big about rooting out the evildoers who put the money up for terrorist attacks, this is not an area that the big banks and some of our supposed allies really want to have deeply investigated. So Bush very quietly zeroed out a request by the IRS to increase by half the number of investigators it has to follow the money trail of terrorism. This is painstaking work that requires substantial staff with the expertise, time, and backing to do the job. But in his latest budget, which George hailed as evidence of his robust pursuit of the bad guys, there is zero funding for the 80 additional criminal investigators requested by the IRS. This would not have come to light at all, except that it was mentioned in one sentence on the last page of a routine report to an obscure congressional subcommittee by an even more obscure IRS oversight board. Bush's defunding of IRS's financial diggers was caught by one alert committee member, Representative Earl Pomeroy, who has since been directing some very robust questions to the White House. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Bush PR flack responded that the Treasury Department, of which the IRS is a part, got an overall budget increase, which she says demonstrates Bush's robust commitment to tracking terrorist money. But since that still doesn't get the IRS the agents it needs, I'd call that a robust dodge.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec, nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And I think one thing that they probably don't want you to know much about is the Gore Commission and how Al Gore, 7 years ago, was talking about airline safety and security. And if you want to call in and ask questions of our guest, Dr. Elaine Kmark, who is a professor at Harvard University and a staff member on the Gore Commission for Aviation Security and Safety, call in. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. We appreciate your calls. It's 877-57-SCOOP. And you can also send an email, if you wish, by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at radioinsidescoop.com. And actually, I want to read an email that I just received, Dr. Kmark. It's from Bert in Minnesota, and Bert writes, Republicans always seem to be arguing for smaller and smaller government. And of course, there's always the howler by Grover Norquist about getting government to the size where he can strangle it in his bathtub. To this end, they say they want to reduce taxes. But to listen to your guests talking and how we wanted oversight and standards for airline personnel and security people, we needed government here. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, yeah, look, in retrospect, obviously he's right, okay? Obviously we were asking something of the airlines that they couldn't, that they weren't going to do, and we probably needed to make these public eventually. But at the time, there was no way Congress would have passed this, so it was a moot point. So what we did is we, in fact, passed a series of laws that increased the qualification requirements for these airplane screeners, because there was a regulatory authority over the screeners. Now, interestingly enough, the issue of the screeners is still there. There's a new study out that shows that, you know, there's still some private screening companies working, and it shows
I thought that we required them all to be public.
No, there's still some private screening companies that are working, that are contracted by the government. And it turns out that there's generally a problem with screeners, that there's not much difference between the quality, public and private, and that the issue still is today, as it was back in 1996, that somehow we have to improve the quality of the screener.
Are they falling asleep? I mean, when you say the quality...
It's a very, very difficult job. It's an incredibly boring job.
Yeah.
It's a job that requires high degrees of training and high degrees of testing. And frankly, one of the things we've now learned is that even though we feel a little bit better, I think, because they are government screeners, the fact is that the empirical tests are showing there's not too much difference, and we still have to work on this problem.
I'd like if you could explain some of the politics of this. You said just a few moments ago that there was no way Congress would have passed a law to do some of these safety and security things that were necessary 7 years ago. I certainly know that the Republicans controlled Congress back in the later days of the Clinton administration. What some of our listeners may not know, I know because I worked for the Democrats on the Hill, is that even if a bill has a majority, at least in the House, if it has a majority of congressmen that support it, it still doesn't become law unless you can get a vote on it. And you can't get a vote on it unless the majority party decides to give you a vote on it. So even if you have a bill that's got two-thirds support, if it doesn't have a majority of Republicans and Tom DeLay doesn't say it's okay, it doesn't get to the floor. Can you tell me why this kind of bill would not have had support in Congress back then?
Well, what you would have done is taken a huge amount of money and added 65,000 people to the payroll of the U.S. government. And there was no way the Republicans were going to let us do that. And frankly, the rest of the country would have thought we were probably insane. Okay? Especially because, what happened is that quickly thereafter, and this is just what happens a lot of times with public policy problems, is that it was clear that this wasn't a terrorist attack, that it was an explosion due to mechanical problems. And so all the sort of initial political energy behind this fell away, and we were left basically by ourselves fighting the airlines and their lobbyists and their lawyers. And they, of course, had a lot of support in the Republican Congress. So there was really no point in doing that.
Dr. K. Mark, one of the recommendations I did notice in the commission's report was an increase in FBI agents. And I want to sort of tie that to the ultimate question that I asked just before we went to break, and that is whether you think if Al Gore had been properly allowed to be president by the Supreme Court, if they'd counted the votes in Florida, all the votes, whether you think there would have been a difference between whether 9/11 indeed might have been prevented. It's a big question. It's a hypothetical, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
I've been asked this question before, and I think the right answer is that the probability that it would have been prevented, it would have increased.
Okay.
But I obviously can't say absolutely. And it would have increased for two different reasons.
Okay.
One is that the airlines who began to really drag their feet in 99 and 2000, as it looked like, because people forget in those 2 years, Gore was always running behind Bush.
Right.
The fact that he won in the end was capping rather late. So first of all, the airlines really were emboldened to drag their feet on the security recommendations. And I don't think if Gore had been running ahead during that period of time, if they had thought they were going to have to contend with him for another 4 or 8 years, I think that more of these things might have been put in place. But I think the second reason is kind of unrelated to our topic, but it's equally relevant, which is that we all had 8 years to get to know Dick Clark and to see the evolution of Al-Qaeda and this terrorist threat.
Yep.
So during the transition in 2001, whoever Al Gore's national security advisor was would not have told Dick Clark to go away, we're going to do our own study.
Right.
They would have taken that right away and run with it and tried a policy of disrupting Al-Qaeda as opposed to, you know, waiting until September the 10th to have their own independent study already concluded.
And in fact, although Condoleezza Rice doesn't like to call it a plan, she likes to call it a series of actionable items, there was clearly a plan plan by the Clinton administration to respond
right.
to the USS Cole bombing.
I don't quite understand what the difference between a plan is and actionable items.
Well, it all depends on what the definition of plan is,
right.
apparently.
I think we would have been – I don't think Al Gore would have delayed this. I think we would have had a lot of activity going on in 2001 that was delayed because the Bush administration was thinking about it. But in the end, to be fair, I don't know if any of that would have in fact prevented it.
I want to go to the phones. I got a caller on the air. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Dr. K. Mark, what's your first name and where are you from?
Hi, Mark. I'm Brian from Cherry Hill.
Hi, Brian from Cherry Hill. What's your comment or question?
I had a comment about airport security.
Yeah.
And I do agree that it's pretty horrible and extremely random. And I mean, hey, if you want to play a number game, sure, random is good, but we're not playing casino here. We're playing lives, and they're just, okay, I'll check your shoes, or, oh, no, you come over here, and I'll check your bag. If you're going to have airport security, everybody gets checked, including, in my opinion, I don't know how you do this, but I think some of the screeners, and you're saying you have to screen these people, but I'm sorry, some of these people I would not trust with, and we do, but I wouldn't trust with my life.
Tell me this, what about us, and I think we all have our own views on this, but what about a screener makes you think you don't trust them? Are they not awake? Do they look not too smart? What about it?
The biggest thing is I'm looking for someone who is thorough. If you're checking for guns or knives or explosives or whatever, you open that book bag. If you're going to open it, you just don't shift around the clothes and say, oh, everything's okay. No.
So you don't think they're doing enough of a thorough job then?
They're definitely not.
Dr. K-Mark, do you think that we have – I mean, do you think our screeners are doing a good enough job now? Do you think that – what can we in government do to make better screeners?
Well, this is a very hard question because they're not doing a good job. There have been several tests on them that show that things are getting past them.
There's that guy that put all those things in Southwest Airlines. I forget that. Which, by the way, I'm grateful for, the college student, and then notified authorities, although apparently he was arrested for it.
Yeah, I know. It's a difficult problem on how sort of how to deal with that. Look, the fact of the matter is that we're going to have to spend even more money on it. And we're going to have to do another thing that is going to be very difficult. We're probably going to have to figure out better ways to select who we screen. And that might mean letting some people volunteer to have a full field security check
mm-hmm.
and volunteer, because the only way we could do this and keep our civil liberties would be volunteer,
mm-hmm.
volunteer to have a fingerprint or some sort of biometric card made of them, so that at least we take some portion of the flying public out of the need to be searched so thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons, of course, that the screeners do such cursory searches is that, you know, the lines back up and people are angry and they hear people yelling at them and people are worried about their planes being missed because right now we're trying to screen every single person. And we're not, as the caller said, we're not doing a very good job of screening every single person. We've got to figure out a way to better target who we need to screen, and that probably means using a lot of technology and letting some people volunteer to have investigations made of themselves so at least they can, you know, not make the lines longer.
And do you think if we had those investigations, why couldn't an Al-Qaeda, I don't know, get someone who's like Richard Reid or someone, a British citizen, someone who's a true believer but not readily noticeable.
Because you'd have to do the kind of investigation that the government does for a clearance.
Okay, so you look at their friends and neighbors.
Something like that could never pass.
I see. Hey, Brian from Cherry Hill, would you undergo that kind of background check or would you avoid it?
No, whatever. I'd go through it if it would work, but to kind of bring it back real quick about the money, that it would cost a lot of money to have more screeners.
Yeah.
Well, money makes it worth it to fly then. Don't take it for granted that, I'm just going to catch a plane to Cleveland tonight.
Yeah.
Like, it's a privilege. I'm sorry. Yeah, we live in America, and it's a wonderful country, and I love it. But if you can't take a plane to Cleveland because we need to spend a little bit more money, or if you can't afford it, take a train or take a bus. And that's just my opinion.
Yeah, and we spend $100 billion a year now on Iraq. You'd think we could spend, a much lesser amount on air security. Thanks very much for your call, Brian. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark, for the show. It's wonderful.
Thank you. Dr. K. Mark, how much money would it cost to do it right, in your view?
Well, it's probably double what we now spend. But part of the challenge before us in the next 10 years is actually going to be to do it smarter. In other words, to figure out some way to get people through airports in a reasonably efficient manner, and also to better target the people that we really ought to be looking at. And I think that right now what the government's doing is completely backwards. They're just trying to target every single person. As a result, you get these cursory looks into your bag, and the little old ladies that fly every week to see their grandchild, they right. get stopped as often as some stranger who's been in the country for 2 weeks. So this is simply not working, and we've got to figure out a better way to make this work, because otherwise it's going to be not only very, very expensive, but it's also going to be enormously time-consuming and inefficient, and we have to worry about those things.
Dr. Kabar, I got one last question, then I'll let you go. But this is a very important question, and I know because when I worked on the Committee on Homeland Security that oversees the Department of Homeland Security, Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts every time he got there would raise this point, and no one ever had any answers. And his point was this: when you go to the airport, they take your shoes off, they look through your stuff, but when you mail something, when you just mail a package, most people don't even realize that most mail that goes through the post office goes underneath passenger planes and is not checked at all. And Congressman Markey is extremely concerned that someone's going to put a bomb in one of those packages. I want to know if I looked at the Gore Commission's report, and I know that there were some things about customs being able to check mail. What was the Gore Commission's recommendation for mail security, and how much of that has been implemented?
We had several different recommendations on mail security. Initially, they were resisted by the U.S. Post Office, which said, no, this is going to be too expensive, too inefficient, et cetera. In the wake of the anthrax mailings, however, their attitudes have changed pretty dramatically.
Okay.
Now, part of the problem there, again, goes back to money, which is you need explosive detection screening devices. You know, you need to be able to have
sure.
some machine that you put the mail through
sure.
To do it. And, again, this is up to Congress and it's up to the government to find the money to make sure we have those things. But the congressman is absolutely right. It's something that we identified 8 years ago now, which is the mail is another source of vulnerability in addition to passengers and in addition to baggage. It's another source of vulnerability to airplanes.
It's just very scary. You know, I mean, we go through these detailed checks. They'd make us take our shoes off. And somebody who isn't, I mean, one of the ways, in fact, I know that El Al prevents attacks is there are not that many suiciders. There are enough. Unfortunately, way too much in the world, but they do bag match, I know, to make sure
yes.
that if you're on the plane, the bag has to be on the plane so that if it's going to blow up, it's going to take you with it. And like I said, there are unfortunately too many, but still not that many people willing to totally give their lives. In mail, you just mail a package and you don't risk anything. And I would hope that above all, I mean, Congressman Markey's got me very scared, and I think he's right. Is anything being done about that now?
Yeah, there is much more being done about that, after 9/11 and after the anthrax. But again, it boils down to having these detection devices at all the airports or at the postal offices at the airports, and there's certainly many, many more of these machines around than there used to be, and in fact the first group was bought in September 1996, right after TWA 800 crashed. That was the first group the government bought. But again, there are not nearly enough of these, particularly at smaller airports. And getting these machines in has been a long saga of lots of problems. For instance, in some airports, the federal government delivered the machine only to find that these machines are very, very heavy, and the flooring in the airport wasn't strong enough to support the machine.
Wow.
So they had to then rebuild the airport, and the machine sort of sat, wrapped in its wrapping paper
right.
while they were having to reconstruct the airport. So there's been a lot of delays because we didn't ever build airports with all these security measures in mind. A lot has happened. A lot has improved since the mid-90s There's no doubt about it. And a lot of these rules, which we fought the hardest for, like bag match, which were delayed and delayed and delayed through the 90s, suddenly were passed into law right after September 11th. So September 11th was a wake-up call. I don't think it's been enough of a wake-up call, but I think we're probably a little bit better off than we were, but we've got a long way to go.
Well, Dr. K. Mark, you've been a terrific guest. You've really helped to inform a lot of people who probably have never even heard of the Gore Commission, unfortunately. I want to thank you very much for coming on the Inside Scoop.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Well, you heard it. I think the bottom line, and she gave it to me, that she said that if Al Gore were president, it's more probable that we would have prevented the September 11th attacks. I think that was a careful and yet reasonable answer that she gave. Look, Al Gore was farsighted in all kinds of ways, whether environmentally. I mean, he saw that we shouldn't rely on foreign oil so much and protect it. He was one of the first environmentalists. Yes, he actually did play a major role in the Internet. The Internet was, of course, not invented by him. Gore never claimed to have invented the Internet. But he did play a major role, probably the most important role in government, in helping bring the Internet to us in a way that wasn't just used by military and people in academia, but actually used by all of us today. And it's amazing to me how easy it is, how quick we are to write off people who lose elections. Now, of course, Al Gore didn't lose the election. He won the election, not just the popular vote, but the electoral vote too. But because he didn't take the presidency, because of the Supreme Court's really atrocious ruling, I think people often write people off and say, oh, well, I'm so glad Bush is president, or things like that. I know my listeners don't do that, but your friends do it. Your family does it. You know who these people are. And I really thought it was important to show that Al Gore really was farsighted, not just about the environment, not just about the Internet, but also about something as important as airline safety. No, he didn't predict everything. He didn't predict that they were going to hijack planes and ran them into buildings. We did have information on that score. We certainly, as we know now, we knew that the FBI had actually captured a guy named Zacharias Moussaoui, who was connected to Al-Qaeda, who didn't want to take off planes, didn't want to land planes, just wanted to fly planes. And not only that, but we know today that even George Tenet, the director of the CIA, knew that information. Now, he claims he never told the president, even though he met with him every day. But I don't think any of us can believe that, for the very simple reason that if George Tenet failed to tell the president about the people that did 9/11, and also failed in Iraq, claiming that weapons of mass destruction was a slam dunk, if it was entirely Tenet's fault, don't you think he'd be out of a job by now? Don't you think the president would fire him? I think the only reason George Tenet has a job is because he lies for the president so successfully, and I'd like to see him gone. Hey, listen, that's it for the Inside Scoop. I want to tell you about, though, what's coming up. We've got a great show tomorrow. It's called How Do You Solve a Problem Like Scalia? Some have said that's the first Inside Scoop musical. I don't know. I don't know if someone will actually get me to sing on air. You probably don't want to hear that. It could be painful for all concerned. But the point is that Antonin Scalia represents a justice system, a Supreme Court that has gone really radically awry. I mean, it's way, way off. And it's ironic because Scalia claims to be a strict constructionist. He claims to be someone who cares about the law and the Constitution. But we find that time and time again, he radically doesn't want to follow the text of the law, doesn't want to follow the Constitution. And we're going to explore all of this tomorrow in all its context. We'll start with the decision in Bush v. Gore, and we'll go on. We'll explore the political gerrymandering that allows Republicans, even though they don't get a majority in elections, to still have a majority in members of Congress. You'd think that would be anti-democratic. You'd think that would be un-American. But Scalia loves it. Just like Scalia likes taking Americans and putting them in jail forever without a trial, without a charge. He thinks the president has an inherent right to do this, even though it's nowhere in the Constitution. Some strict constructionists. It should be a very interesting show. I'm going to use my background as a constitutional lawyer and also as someone who's written very much about the Gore v. Bush decision. I don't know how many of you know this, but I actually drafted the brief for the Congressional Black Caucus that challenged the Florida electors. But it's much more than Gore v. Bush. I want to have a whole discussion of where the Supreme Court is, what they're doing, and why they're doing it, and the kind of in-depth discussion that we have here on The Inside Scoop. And if you want to support The Inside Scoop, I really encourage you to do so. One of the best ways to do that, if you want to advertise a product on The Inside Scoop, I'd love to sponsor it. Or in general, if you like what I do on the air, let people know. Tell your satellite radio. Tell your local radio station. Tell the people at Air America they need Mark Levine's voice on the air. If you like my show, and I'm getting a lot of regular listeners, tell people about it. Tell your friends. Email them. Let them know that they can hear it here on RadioPower.org or on my website at RadioInsideScoop.com, which, by the way, is going to undergo a whole new cosmetic improvements. In 1 week, you're going to see a whole new website. Just like Gore reinvented government, I'm going to reinvent my website. Let me read one last email before we sign off. It's from Gordon in Michigan, and he writes, "Hi, separate belly cargo from passenger flights or passenger screening becomes a relatively moot point. Also, two air marshals per flight could have stopped six men with box cutters." Well, Gordon, just to separate your points, I do think two air marshals could have stopped the six men, but Dr. Kmark, as she points out, says that if we, you know, maybe we passengers can stop the men as well. But definitely, the air marshals could have stopped it. As far as your interesting proposal about separating belly cargo from passenger flights, actually, that's another thing that El Al does. They actually not only run the bags through decompression chambers, but the chambers of the airlines can withstand most explosions without breaking and be able to land the passenger safely. We found that, unfortunately, in America, they don't want to spend the kind of money that they're doing in El Al. But I'll tell one last story before we close about my experience with El Al. They are great at asking questions. Now, again, I don't know that we can afford to do all this in America, but I remember that when I flew El Al, they asked me where I went to college. I said I went to Harvard. They asked me what I was taking. That year I was taking a course in modern art, and then they asked me some questions about modern art. Only in Israel would a airline screener ask me questions about modern art, and I had better know the answer if I wanted to board that plane. I guess I should have studied more. Hey, this is Mark Levine. That's it for The Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow with our first musical, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Scalia? And tune in 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 Central, 1 Mountain, and noon Pacific here on The Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.